Before we begin, we'd like to ask a favor. If you could take a moment to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, we'd really appreciate it. We're told it helps the show find new listeners. Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to the BLB podcast. This is the seventh episode in a series where we talk about the short story form, the writing process, and how to get published. The BLB podcast is a new project from Brick Lane Bookshop, an independent bookshop on Brick Lane, London. I'm Kate Ellis, and this is my co-host, Peter J. Coles.
Hello.
Hello, Peter. Today, we are very excited to be talking to Neve Mulvey, author of Hearts and Bones.
Neve Mulvey is a writer and editor. She has published short fiction in The Stinging Fly, Banshee, Little Atoms, and Southward, and was shortlisted for the Sean O'Fallon Prize for Short Fiction in 2020. She has also written for The Irish Times, The Bookseller, Image Magazine, and The Pool. Originally from Kilkenny, Ireland, she now lives in South London. Hearts and Bones is her debut short story collection from Picador.
Neve is going to read from The Doll. Are you ready to go, Neve?
I am. It was offensive how healthy Aoife was. She had broad shoulders and strong, well-shaped legs. She wore short skirts with thin strap sandals, and when she strode across the street in those dumb little shoes, he couldn't believe they didn't end up crushed to pieces under her sexy pink feet. She had been hurt badly in a previous relationship. The other guy used her and then made her feel like the using was something she specifically requested. She had been smart enough to see through it, so she'd gotten out of it. But she was still heartbroken, Dar could tell. She was still heartbroken in a way he could only ever dream of making her feel. They had only been together for a few weeks, but already he knew she was slipping away. He was too weird for her, too intense. He was funny. On a good night out, he could keep a whole group of them entertained with his impressions for hours, and she had much admired his dark eyes and curly hair in the early moments of their relationship. But there was all of that other stuff underneath, and she could smell it. He was astounded. What was this instinct that even someone as straightforward, as untroubled as her, could access? Maybe there was something else going on. Maybe he wasn't a materialist atheist after all. But though all of that could be intellectually kind of thrilling, especially after smoking when everything seemed abstract and possible, in the sad reality that was his life, it just meant he was about to get his heart crushed again. So he was getting into ventriloquism as a way to handle it all. They moved in the kind of circles that made this just about acceptable. They were all back home just after college, all waiting for their lives to properly start, all mostly living with their parents. Dara bought a shiny-faced dummy online. Called him Stuart. They didn't know anyone called Stuart, and it was instantly hilarious. Dara started bringing Stuart to the pub. Aoife seemed thrown by this, but when she saw how everyone else loved and accepted Stuart, she laughed along too. Dara had no intention of working on his technique. That would have been crazy. It would have taken up far too much time, and for what? So instead, he just sat Stuart beside him at the pub and treated him as if he were a real person. Everyone was fine with it. Soon, Stuart found his way into Dara's impersonations. Dara didn't have an official act, but he would end up performing most Friday nights out in the smoking area, in between roll-up cigarettes and pints of 6% beer. Stuart would sit alongside him, making vicious comments about the person Dara was impersonating, or, after a while, his actual impersonation. That then evolved into Stuart making vicious comments about Dara himself. And so it soon became that Dara would carry around a doll whose only function was to undercut everything he said with sarcasm, vitriol, or just plain aggression. For example, Dara, I'm going to the bar. Anyone need a drink? Stuart, you're a cunt. Everyone loved it. Stuart's voice grew richer and more distinctive. He adopted an old-fashioned British accent with a nasal twang. It was nasty, authoritative, hilarious. It was coming up to Halloween and Aoife was going to the party at the pub they all went to as a slutty nurse. Dara was disappointed by this. He'd hoped that she had more imagination, but she did look unbelievable in her costume. On the evening of the party, they got ready together in his bedroom at his parents' house. They drank vodka and coke, and Dar played Led Zeppelin on an old CD player that had belonged to one of his brothers, hoping that she would like it. He painted zombie makeup on her face to make her costume scarier and less embarrassing to him. He was good at doing makeup. He was good at anything that involved creating weird or freaky things. He used an eyeliner pencil to draw stitches across her mouth. He noticed how full and pink her bottom lip was. He imagined her biting his finger and wished suddenly that he could stop what he was doing and run his fingers tenderly across her lips. He got aroused thinking about this and had to get up and walk away. He picked up Stuart and brought him over to her. Stuart's face was shiny and cream. His eyes were blue, his hair was black. "Stuart thinks you are too sexy," he said. "He says we need more blood." And then he pretended Stuart was a vampire and he thrust his cold, hard face into the hot crevice of her neck. She seemed startled, but then she laughed. He knew that Aoife didn't like Stuart. He had expected her to be annoyed by him. He anticipated that she would be a little fearful of him. He felt the feeling she was having and he became colder to her. He began to nurture a contempt for her. He imagined her feelings around Stuart to be rooted in revulsion towards him for the person that he was, and towards herself for having liked him in the first place. But she didn't seem to feel like that. Instead, she seemed upset. She said, "I don't like the things you say about yourself with that doll. I don't get the joke." Women have a shit sense of humour. He'd always tried hard not to think that. He knew he wasn't supposed to think that, but it was so true. They'd never had sex. He hadn't had much experience. When he was in fifth year, he went to Dublin a few times to meet up with the girl he'd become friends with online. She was glum and funny, like him. They had done it once. It had been kind of awful. He couldn't think about it without wincing. It was confusing. She seemed like she wanted to do it, even though he, the first time, had been scared. And so they had. Afterwards, she couldn't meet his eye. And so he withdrew because he was terrified he'd done something wrong. He became icy with her and she became sullen with him. It all ended with him getting on the bus to go home one evening after a long, terrible day walking around the city. And she flicked her cigarette in his direction and didn't even say goodbye. And then with Aoife, they just didn't get around to it. They were both living at home with their parents. Their relationship had started slowly, drunken snogs on nights out. They had done some sexual things together, but he had always stopped it, and she seemed embarrassed, and they quickly got dressed. So it was barely a relationship. They didn't have sex. He didn't really like her. "But still," he said to Stuart after the breakup, "but still, I feel like shit." "You are shit," said Stuart. He laughed. Stuart always made him feel so much better.
Thank you so much. That was great. Really good to get a taste of Stuart. His role seems to be to undercut everything, especially Hannah.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of people have responded to that story, which has been really, really interesting. It was one of the ones that I didn't plan at all. It just sort of came almost like out of nowhere.
That's interesting because it feels like it's because it's the only story in the collection that's structured in three parts. I imagined it might have been carefully plotted.
No, I remember I started it thinking of this relationship between Aoife and Dar, although I didn't know their names, but just I could really see him looking at her and feeling all the things that he feels. And I wrote the first two paragraphs almost, and they're still almost exactly as they are. Like I did a lot of editorial work later, but the beginning hasn't changed that much. And you know, in the very beginning, there's a lot, it's very much in his head. It's all like, and then as I was writing, I started to feel this is too internal. I needed something external, like a thing, very real. And then literally I just was like, it almost like wrote itself. It just, a ventriloquist dummy was like the answer, almost like to a technical problem, more so than a plot problem. And then I just... So I really just trusted that and let Stuart lead the story.
But I was wondering if you could describe the collection as you see it, because it's not all like this, obviously. There's a different, yeah.
Yeah, I think that story is almost quite unrepresentative, I think, because I think it's quite a traditional book of stories, as in like the themes I think that it explores are quite, you know, there's nothing new. It's very much about families and relationships. And change, I think. When I started writing it, I had been trying to write for a really long time. I'd written a couple of novels and they were kind of okay, but not just good enough, really. And I think I used to think about them in almost like too big a way, in a way, like in a sort of thematic way or issues way, or what does this novel say about me, the writer? You know, that was the way I was thinking. I didn't know that, but now that I look back, I think that is the way. But with these stories, I had just kind of given up on writing and I'd left my job in publishing and I was like, I'm going to do something else and move forward in my life. Then the stories just came and they were very much about two people, like one person looking at another person, feeling something that they couldn't express properly. And I wrote, the first story I wrote in the collection is First Time, which is a sort of a young teenage relationship-y story. And I could just really feel the way the young boy or the young man in that story was feeling. And I just wrote it really fast. And even though it wasn't that good, it needed a lot of work, I knew it was true. And I knew it was different to anything I'd ever written before. And so I just really wanted to, and then I was like, don't ruin this with your stupid brain, like your stupid writing brain. And so then from that point on, I started to think of each story as a song, like as a pop song. So it was, and you know the way pop songs are almost always use like you and I rather than she or her or he. It's very much somebody looking at somebody else. So that is what I just wanted to kind of capture. And if I could get that, then I could build the story around that feeling.
I think a lot of your stories, the characters on the surface are very fortunate and privileged and they're wealthy. And I think this ties into what you're saying, but their interior thoughts unpick themselves. They often question their situation. Is that you kind of trying to unpick their privilege or the sheen of how they present?
Yeah, maybe. I guess I hadn't really thought about it in that way. But I think that's most true in the first story, in Mother's Day, where you have this woman who has kind of married into wealth and she is meeting her mother who is not wealthy. And there's a, you know, there's been a sort of estrangement between them, and the daughter is really wants to reconnect with the mother, but but she just can't find the right way to do it. It's funny with that story because people always ask me, do you know about how the daughter is like this really horrible character. She's really mean to her mother, and you know, do I dislike her? You know, but because that story is in the first person, all I feel in that story is the daughter. And it's so, one thing that's been so interesting is that actual readers, they don't just feel that. They feel the mother. They feel the other sides of it. And I just love that because it's just so fascinating the way, because for me, when I read that story, all I can feel is the daughter's feelings because that was what I built it on. And I wrote it all from her point of view and it's in the first person. And all I know as the writer is her experience. I don't know what the mother feels, but readers, they do, or they have a much better idea actually of what the mother is feeling than I do. And that's been kind of mind blowing. I'm still sort of figuring out what that really means, you know?
I guess when you have a book out, you kind of hear other people's ideas about your own ideas. And it's a strange thing. But I think in that story, I was interested in the mother, and maybe it's the sort of instinct of backing the underdog. She's in a bad situation and you kind of want her to be okay. And the daughter is helping her on the surface, but you don't get the impression that anything is going to change.
I know, it's really sad. I actually feel so emotional about that story, even though like it's nothing based on my own life. Like I have a really great relationship with my mother, thankfully. But I just really feel the daughter's sadness in that story. I started reading it at my book launch in Dublin last week. And I couldn't get through it. I just got too emotional. So my dad got up and he read the whole thing the whole way through. It was really embarrassing. But also I think kind of nice and annoying. And then I recovered and was able to give a proper speech and thank everyone. But yeah, I that story I just find very emotional.
That's so interesting that you feel your stories so profoundly. And I think that does come across in the stories, because one thing that I found was that the stories, they're in a very positive way. They're very simply written. It's very, very easy to read text. I'm not lost. I know exactly what's happening. What's your editing process when it comes to these stories then, if they're to make them so sort of simple, so sort of easy to read?
It's been kind of a new process. Like, as I said, I have been writing for years, but I think I was overcomplicating it for a long time. And so when I started to write in this kind of new way, I think I have quite a simple brain. You know, I'm not, I can only really think about one thing at a time, you know, so like I have to really be in the mindset of one character, you know, and I don't have any space for anything else. So I just have to be in that feeling that they're feeling and just write that. And then trust that almost in a way to kind of ease the storytelling. And I really wanted to not try and impress anyone. You know, that was very important, that there was no sense of trying to be sound clever or cool or topical or relevant. Like I just don't have enough brain space to have those considerations in mind. It's all about this character, what they're feeling, and what they're going to do about that feeling. And that just takes up all the space. I don't have enough space for anything else. And then when it comes to the editing process, you know, I did have quite a lot. So I had a lot of work to do on these stories, even after they sold and I got the feedback from the editor. I feel like they were at like maybe 70%. And I really wanted them to be closer to 90 before they went out into the world. You know, I knew they would never be at 100, but getting that, like, getting them to 70, like writing the first drafts, was easy. I was just in the zone. I wrote all these stories. They came so naturally. And I wrote them mostly in 2020 in lockdown. But that last bit of trying to like get them to that level that I knew I could say, right, this is good enough. You know, they can stand up by themselves. That took a lot of quite agonizing work. But again, it wasn't, I think I naturally write quite simply because I think I'm just quite a simply minded person. but the editing process was about being just really, really ruthlessly honest. Like, would this character really do that? Would they really think that? Or am I just trying to be smart and clever? Am I just trying to be cool and interesting? You know, and there were places that I was doing that. So the editing process was almost much more about just undoing that and just stripping it back to the kind of bone of the character.
Just one quick question. You said that the book is written sort of at the beginning of the millennium, right? It's sort of 2000s, 2010-ish. I can't pronounce it, Fjallajökull, the Icelandic volcano is mentioned at some point. Well, that's 2009, I think it was. Why did you choose to set the stories then?
Well, they're actually from around 2000 to around 2019, pre-pandemic. So they kind of covered the, like 20 years. And I think the ones that you notice the time period are those ones from earlier time periods, I guess. Like, say, Mother's Day, that first one, that's kind of is more like contemporary, because I think I refer obliquely to the Sacklers and that, and the idea that the art world is so much more kind of commercially driven than it used to be. But again, it just emerged from the stories, you know, just as I was writing them. Like, the first one I wrote was definitely set in around the year 2000 when I was a teenager. And it's very much of that moment in time in Ireland and the Celtic Tiger. And it's kind of like a Celtic Tiger story, that story. And then I didn't plan, I just wrote. And then it was only when I had a few on my hands, I could see then that what was emerging, you know. And then, you know, as you know, as booksellers, and as I know, as somebody in the business, when it comes to selling a collection, it's really hard. You have to kind of give people something to kind of hang on to in terms of what is this about? So then I was like, well, one of the things is about is about the change that has occurred in Ireland over those 20 years. But that's definitely something that kind of emerged from the work, rather than I didn't set out to kind of do that, you know, in a sort of sociological experiment sort of way. It was just, you know, I guess I, you know, it's the age that I am as well. You know, I'm in my late 30s. And I think now is a really interesting time as an artist and as a person at this age, because you can, you know, enough time has passed in your life for you to have changed quite a lot, and for things in your life to have changed, and for the world to have changed. And I think change is what drives story, I think. So yeah, I think it was that's where that came from. It came from the stories rather than from me deciding that's what I was going to do.
You mentioned that you worked in publishing for a long time. I was wondering how that affects your experience of having a book in the world. So obviously you know the industry, you know the processes. Does it shift your thinking on it?
Yeah, like obviously I have no idea who I would be if I hadn't worked in publishing. But I imagine, I was just saying to you before, Case, that you know, having a book come out is quite a terrifying experience, even if it's like, you know, it's a small book. It's not like it's, you know, thousands and thousands of copies in Smiths or anything, but still it's kind of exposing and all of that. But I think the advantage that I have is that I've seen other people go through this, you know, so I know if I'm seeing them and talking to them, I kind of know how it feels. And I know, you know, there are certain things about the publication process that you can control. And there are many, many, many things that you can't, you know, and I think, you know, having a good understanding of that has made it easier for me to just sort of keep my head, you know, in this time of a coming out into the world and, you know, bad reviews or it not doing well and all of that. Like, I kind of know to expect that and, you know, to almost like preempt those challenges and just be like, well, to me, the most important thing is the work. And if I'm trying to keep working and keep writing throughout this process just to, because that's what's important. And everything else in a way is just kind of noise. But if you just keep your eye on the work itself, then you can kind of, you can go through those more troubling moments along the way. Because with publishing, it's very hard and there's very little that you can control. And there's so many books out there.
Yeah, it's an emotional roller coaster.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I'm glad I'm a bit older as well. I think going through this process as a young writer must be really, really hard.
The BOB podcast is brought to you by Brick Lane Bookshop. As a thank you for listening to us talk about short stories, we're offering all listeners a 10% discount. Just use the code BLBPOD, that's BLBPOD, for a 10% discount off any purchase at bricklanebookshop.org.
Stories, there's the relationship with the daughter and the mother seems to be a bit fractious, and a couple of times it's sort of mentioned that the mother is a cleaner or something like this, and there seems to be a sense of guilt maybe about maybe the life that the daughter is now leading and the sort of leaving the mother behind. But it's earlier on you mentioned that you don't really have that relationship with your mother. With this, are you sort of fearful about like the sort of how people are going to maybe perceive you as the author from the work?
Maybe, although the good thing about a short story collection is there's so many stories that like, and there's lots of different situations. But yeah, that question about the mother and daughter thing, I must ask my mother what she thinks about that. But she's a really, really big reader. You know, she reads everything and I really trust her opinion on books, you know. And I think the tension that you pointed to in terms of a lot of the younger women in the stories, you know, having better kind of career prospects than their mothers did, like that's very much a kind of historical fact of people of my generation. You know, most people my age in Ireland, most of us went to university or had the opportunity to go to university, and most of our parents didn't. So and I find that's just such an interesting tension and an interesting fact. And I kind of try to approach it as a writer in a very, you know, I'm not a historian or a sociologist. I don't have to, you know, I'm not political in a way. I don't care so much about all that stuff. What I care about is the feelings that creates within families and how the characters that I'm thinking about, you know, how those great changes have kind of, you know, emerged through, unfolded through their lives and what effect that has on their relationships, on their personal relationships, really. So yeah, my mom, she hasn't told me off yet, but you know.
Has she read them?
Yeah, she's read them. She's I can't remember. Yeah, no, she read them at proof stage. But yeah, no, my parents have always been like, you know, just so supportive of my writing, like both of them. They're both have like, my mother is a psychiatric nurse. So maybe that's where my interest in, you know, mental illness and madness comes from. And my father is, you know, works in the public sector as well as an accountant. They live in a small town in Ireland. They didn't go to university in the way that I did, and you know, they trained a bit later while we were all growing up. So it was just they've had a very different life to what I've had. It's been, I'd say, just generationally, it's been a huge change. And I think that's pretty typical, I think, of people of my generation in Ireland. And I'm very interested in that change.
Yeah, you in a lot of your stories, they're set often over a short time period, but you get the sense that the actions in the stories are going to kind of reverberate into the future, or they're inspired by the past. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how you use time in your writing.
Oh, that's a good question. I think I can't remember who said this, but somebody I was reading recently, it might have been John Banville or it might have been the Spanish writer Javier Cercas. I don't know if I'm saying that right. But one of them said that the past is not past, it's just a dimension of the present. And I think that's really true, that we, and it becomes increasingly true the older you are. Like if you look at children, you know, I have two small children and they're just so free of past. Everything is the present with them. And that's why they're so difficult because, you know, they have an ice cream that falls on the floor. They're completely devastated because that means, because everything is right now. So that ice cream is gone. It's gone forever. And they'll never get, they're not thinking about future ice creams or past ice creams. It's just like right now, no ice cream equals devastation, you know? And, but that's what's so wonderful about them too, because like when they're joyful, they're just so joyful. There's nothing else there. But the older we get, the more we accumulate in terms of like experience and pain and time, and we bring all of that to, you know, to interactions with each other, you know. And I think I am, you know, I think I'm an optimistic person, and I do think that, you know, we can challenge that, you know, we can change our own thinking about who we are and our past, because in a way who we are is the same thing as our past in a way. But I think we can change that. And I think in the stories, that's what I'm most interested in is that moment of like somebody just seeing things just a little bit more clearly, just for a second, and then progressing on from there. And I think that's what storytelling is like on the sort of deepest level. It's like how we incorporate new information about the world into our understanding of the world. And if we can be brave enough to incorporate new understanding about ourselves, you know, things that we don't want to know, bad, you know, kind of failings and things that we've done to hurt people, but if we can kind of understand that, but then keep on going and moving forward. So I hope it's not too depressing, the stories. Like there is a lot of sad stuff in them, but I think most of them do end with a bit of an indication towards hope.
The title piece, Hearts and Bones, I was rereading it again today just for the interview. And obviously it's going to be talked about, I think, because of the situation that's happening in the world, especially in America at the moment, in terms of like, you know, abortion and things like that. And I think what you were just saying just there about the characters sort of having to deal with the situation they're in and the sort of evolving from it. Nell does it miraculously. It's incredible how self-confident she is. But at the end, there does seem to be a bit of sadness and a bit of sort of realization and a bit of sort of, it's almost devastating, I think, at the end there. I wonder if you could talk about that story and maybe in the context of the world as we're in now.
Yeah. So, that story is like a big story for me, really, just in the sense of writing it was a real moment in my sort of mind as an artist and as a creator. I felt like when I wrote it that, I think it was when I first realized, oh, I might be a writer now, you know. And the first draft of it took place in 2002, which is kind of current draft is set, and 2018. For the final version, I've stripped it back just to 2002. So it took place in 2002 and 2018, and there were abortion referendums in Ireland both of those years. So that first draft, I wrote very quickly, and I sent it around to some friends. And it was the first time I'd ever sent any piece of writing to friends who were just normal friends who weren't like writers or, you know, because I just was like, oh, I think this is pretty good. And I just like, would you like to read it? Whereas in the past, I always been so precious and, you know, wouldn't tell anyone I was writing. I was really silly about it. But I was like, oh, what do you think? And so a friend of mine, one of the people who read it said, I liked it a lot, but I really am curious about what happens in between times to this character. And that was a bit of a mind-blowing question. And I actually realized that in order to answer that question, I'd need to write a novel. And so that is what I have done. And the novel is coming out next year, which is that story.
Uh-huh. that's one of our questions is, can you talk about the novel? I read on the AI that is coming out of Picador next year.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Are you allowed to talk about it?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, yeah. I can tell you a bit about it. So then I went away and wrote a whole novel, basically. And I kind of panned out, and it also includes like Nell's mother, Dolores, so back to that idea of the mother and the daughters and the change. So it's sort of set in 1983, kind of 2002, 2018, but it's more like, obviously it's about many years in between those as well. Those years are just kind of like pinprick moments in a way to kind of pin it on, but the whole thing has kind of evolved into this sort of family saga, really, I think is probably the best way to describe it. So I kind of did that and wrote the first draft of the novel, then came back to edit the stories. And it was really hard to look at Hearts and Bones as at that point, because I was like, it wasn't really a short story. It was the first draft of a novel that I didn't know I was going to write. And I was like, how do I make it work on its own terms as a short story and not as the first draft of a novel? And that was really hard, you know, and I was really at a disadvantage because I knew the characters far too well at that point. You know, like Nell had, I kind of know, I've written her whole life story really. And Martina, her mentor, her religious mentor in the story, she's a big part of the novel too. And so I just know them all so well. But a short story is a very different beast to a novel. So what I came back to was, what is that moment of change? You know, And if, like, I tried to sort of obey the rules that I'd set myself in the previous stories, which was all about two characters and their kind of back and forth and feelings and interactions. So it was like, okay, strip it back to Mel and Martina again and to that moment of change between them. And that's how I got to the story that is in the final version. And then in terms of the issue of abortion and that, like, I really don't want to write an issue novel, and I don't really want to talk about it in that way. I'm not interested in thinking about art in that way. I'm just much more interested in how people's feelings drive their decisions about their lives, and how that then, because I see reality sometimes as like there's this like kind of like what you were saying about language case. Like, there's this upper crust of like the high level discourse of politics and history. And then underneath that, there's all the real people going about their business, trying to figure out who they are, what the right thing to do is. And I think, I do despair sometimes about the like increasing like polarization, particularly in America. And we seem to like pin everything on America, and it's very troubling and sad and crazy what's happening there. But if you kind of go beneath that, and if you look at polling and stuff, it shows that people actually are much more convergent in terms of their attitudes towards abortion than the shouty, screamy debate would have you believe.
I think social media has sort of removed nuance, hasn't it, and kind of made given us the impression that attitudes are binary, when of course they're not. They're muddled but with everydayness, and it's, I guess that's what you're interested in. It's the sort of like the everydayness of people's lives that inform their decisions, which go on to change their lives and shift their thinking.
Yeah. No, I just really hope, and I think that everyone I talk to these days is talking about nuance, you know, because people seem to recognize that's what we need now. So that gives me a lot of hope, you know, because I love people. I love talking to people. I'm one of these people who will have a half hour conversation at a bus stop. And I just find typically your average person is very well intentioned and wants to be a decent person on the earth. And I think if we can kind of strip back and maybe think about that, although I don't want to teach any lessons, so stop me, I am teaching any lessons.
I like the idea of you having deep conversations at the bus stop. Are conversations like that inspiring to you? Do they kind of influence your stories, those spark ideas?
Totally, yeah. And I think, I'm from Ireland, obviously, and Ireland is a very talkative place. You know, we talk a lot there. Sometimes we don't say very much, but we do talk a lot. And one thing that's nice about being a Londoner, I consider myself a Londoner now, it's been about 12 years, is that you just meet people who are just completely different in terms of their background, like kind of on a surface level, they're from a different country, different language, different religion. And I just love just being able to connect all the same with that, you know, because I grew up in a very homogenous little small town where everyone is the same religion, you know, not only just the same kind of ethnicity, it's that, you know, Roman Catholic. Kind of shedding it, obviously pretending that it's all, we don't care about that anymore, but still our lives are totally shaped by it. But like, that is my heritage and background, and I didn't meet very many people outside of that bubble until I went to London. And so I'm quite hungry for for other people's ideas, and you know, I'm always having great conversations with Uber drivers, like, you know, I just, because you always meet somebody who's from somewhere totally different, and I often find people are very open to just talking about that.
No, it's interesting what you're saying about being from I'm from Surrey suburbia, and so even I live 20 miles away from where I grew up, but it's a completely different world. And it's very exciting in comparison. So, yeah, it's interesting that other people are hungry for something other than what they know. I like the way I didn't like the way you said you had a simple brain, because you clearly don't. But it's always nice to hear that other writers are bogged down with self-doubt and kind of worrying about whether or not they're a writer. And you said that you'd written two novels previously. Would you mind talking about kind of your journey through to sort of feeling like this is the book that's actually going to make it, and you feel kind of solid in your writerly identity?
I think maybe like a lot of people, I was probably seduced much more by the idea of being a writer rather than doing writing, you know, if you see what I mean. And I read a lot when I was a kid. I was a pretty typical kind of bookish child and young person, and did English at university and kind of really wanted to be a writer, but didn't really know why I wanted to. So I would write things, but even though I didn't have I don't think I had a good sort of critical nose back then, but I still kind of knew they weren't that great, but I kept pushing, but I didn't really enjoy it, you know. And I kind of knew I wasn't good enough. I knew that I wasn't a real writer yet, but I didn't think I ever would be. But I also wanted to be close to writers. I didn't know any writers, I don't think, growing up. And the whole idea of like writing, publishing, that was just really fascinating to me. And so that's why I was like, well, if I can't be a writer, I'll work in publishing. A lot of people, I think that. And I'm, you know, really glad I did that for loads of reasons. It's been a really interesting experience. And while I was working and, you know, in publishing, you have to work really, really hard. I was still trying to write alongside around the same time. But I don't think it really helped, because in the business, you have to think about books as part of a business, and like the pitch, and you know what type of writer you're going to be, and so I think that kind of affected my writing for a while. You know, it was all that whole idea of the kind of external business kind of infected my ability to write. So it took me a really long time, and then you know, a few things in my life changed. I had children, and I kind of wanted to leave publishing then and do something else. I got a bit stuck in my career, and I just said to myself, you only want to be a writer because you've self-propagandized yourself. You know, you only think you want to be a writer because it's a cool idea. And by then the kind of glamour had totally worn off, because I knew so many writers and I knew they were just like normal people, not like, you know, some sort of, I think before I thought they were like in a different like sphere to everyday people. And now I know that is definitely not true. So I was like, okay, I'll just propaganda myself into wanting to do something that makes money. So I'll maybe be like, go work in tech or be an accountant or like, you know, I was like, and that was really freeing, because I think I had really like, you know, set my whole identity around working in publishing and or being a writer. That is like so important to my ego, I guess it was really about. And then I was like, oh, I've kind of failed at working in publishing in the sense that I was kind of stuck in my career, and I've also failed at being a writer, but like I'm still alive, I still am a person. And I think having kids really helped with that, because I remember getting a call around something to do with some job I was applying for, and it was just really crushing news in terms of career. It was like a real humiliation, like not a big deal and nobody did anything wrong, but it was like sometimes you just get a real work humiliation, and it was like, ouch. And like got off the phone, and the kids were looking at me, and I was just like, whatever, they don't care, you know. So, you know, I really picked myself up quite quickly, whereas in the past I think that I would have been like, well, this means I'm not meant to be this, and so I won't try. So then I just kind of let it all go, and then, as I say, that's when the story started to kind of, they kind of like kind of almost grew like little wildflowers, you know. And it was because I wasn't trying. It's like I did all the practice, I did all the skills for like 10 years, and then suddenly I was able to play, you know. And I did, and like, I know it did actually happen almost as dramatically as that. And I know that's quite rare in one's life to have a big change like that, but it was a real mindset change, and it did lead to this book.
As a final question, what are you reading right now? And are there writers or books that you always return to?
Yeah, that's a good question. So at the moment, because of trying to write this novel and this book coming out, my brain is very sort of scattered. So I can't really read demanding contemporary fiction at the moment, which is a shame because I know there's a lot of really good stuff out there. At the moment, I basically read crime novels or thrillers and really serious historical nonfiction. Like that's what my heart wants right now. So I read a lot of Irish history, partly for research and partly just because I'm really interested in history, and also like Russian history, the history of, you know, former Soviet Union, that kind of thing. I kind of like to move between Irish history and Russian history because like it's just this vertiginous, like tiny little place to this massive. In terms of the stories, I was just thinking before we came on, you know, who was I thinking about when I was writing these stories 2 years ago? And I kind of had come back to some writers that I had loved a long time ago but hadn't read. So like just classics like Alice Munro, you know, I reread her a lot, and you know, she's just so true. And she's so much wit in her work. You know, her work is just incredible. And it really, I kind of don't want to read it sometimes because it's so good. I find it a bit intimidating. But, you know, I need to read her. You know, she's like, I just picked her up this morning before coming on the call. And I was thinking of this story, Dance of the Happy Shades, which is just a masterpiece, and I need to reread it again. It's about a music teacher. And then I don't know if I had to pronounce this actually, Yun Li, is that how you say it? The Chinese writer. Again, you know, the talent is just overwhelming and intimidating, but gosh, you know, it's just incredible and so, so inspiring. Like there's a story in this book, which I almost can't read because it's so perfect and brilliant, but absolutely heartbreaking, Immortality. And it's about, it's also about mother and a son in this case. And I think just the epic nature of China's history, then, you know, she writes about that. And it's kind of, I didn't really understand China, and I still don't say that I do, but I think I understand it a little bit better when I read her. And then the other author that meant a lot to me when I was writing these stories is Chekhov, who I hadn't really read before. I'd seen the plays. My mom actually brought me and my sister to his plays years ago up in Dublin. But I read his short stories, and yeah, just the wish and the story that I've taken, is it an epigram? I always forget that word that you use at the beginning. Yeah, from my book is from his story, My Life, which is kind of this, it's kind of a life, it's a life in a short story. It's about this young man growing up in a provincial Russian city, you know, pre-revolution obviously, but he's quite privileged, and he tries to go and live with the people in order to kind of atone for that. And this is the relationship with his father and his sister, and then the people that he tries to live among. And it's just unbelievably relatable and agonizing and beautiful and sad. And the ending is just, I'm getting emotional even thinking about it. So I take great comfort in reading writers who feel like they're from different times and places, but it's the same stuff.
Stuff. I think that's what always shocks me about reading classics is that the emotions feel utterly contemporary. God, this what I'm feeling, what I'm going through, this is just so old.
And even like the political problems that they're talking about, it's the same. Mm-hmm. How do we live among each other peacefully?
How do we be humans?
Which your book covers, your short stories cover really well. It's fascinating. Yeah, I think you're adding to the canon of that, and I think it was really, really fascinating and interesting read.
Yeah. Oh, I'm really glad to hear that. Thank you so much.
Yeah, so I think we've come to the end. Thank you so much for coming onto the podcast, and we wish you the very, very best of luck with Hearts and Bones, which you can get from Brick Lane Bookshop. Wait, is it out yet? Yes.
Last week.
Awesome. So it's definitely out. Go get it. Go grab it. It's very, very good. Highly recommend it.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the BLB podcast. Please remember to rate and review us. We'd love to hear what you think of the show. You can get in touch on social media via @BrickLaneBooks or email us at inquiries@BrickLaneBookshop.org.
This podcast is brought to you by Brick Lane Bookshop. It was produced and edited by Kate Ellis and Peter J. Coles, and music was by Andrew Everett. You can find previous episodes of the podcast at BrickLaneBookshop.org or search Brick Lane Bookshop wherever you find podcasts.